Hey, and welcome to the 6 Minute Mile podcast. Our guest today has produced some of the world's most provocative research demonstrating how exercise fuels not only our bodies, but also our brains. Dr. John Rady is a Harvard psychiatry professor whose books have sold millions of copies worldwide. We are particularly fascinated by SPARK, revolutionary new science of exercise and the brain, and Go Wild, free your body and mind from the afflictions of civilization. In our conversation with Dr. Rady, he explains how exercise can lower rates of depression, cancer, and dementia. On the positive side, exercise can actually promote neurogenesis, allowing us to grow brain cells even at an advanced age. Dr. Rady explains that we can turbocharge brain development with a triple play of exercise, plus immersion in the outdoors, plus working out as part of a group. We also touch on nutrition, alcohol, and overcoming the bummer of short winter days. Enjoy, and we'll see you out there. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We know you've been featured on national networks and TED Talks and major publications, but now we're hoping this is the pinnacle of your career, I'm sure, to be featured on the 6 Minute Mile podcast, right?
Well, it sounds intriguing. I mean, does that mean everybody who gets your newsletter and podcasts are 6 Minute Milers?
We did some research. We found a 5:59 for you. I hope that's not accurate. Otherwise, we'll have to end the interview early. No, we are open to all comers. So it's a 6 Minute Mile, 6 Minute Kilometer, 6 Minute Half Mile. We don't judge. But no, we started this as a little bit of a side project about 2 years ago as an email newsletter, and really seemed to have struck a nerve. We got to, we're over 500,000 subscribers now.
That's great.
Yeah, it's really, you know, it's not our genius. It's really that the subject matter and the way we approach it has really worked. And then we started the podcast a couple months ago, which has been really popular. And it's been a great excuse for us to speak with people like you. And we had Catherine Switzer on a few weeks ago, the first woman to ever run the Boston Marathon, or to officially run the Boston Marathon.
Right.
And we've had Bill Rogers and other authors and commentators. So it's been a lot of fun. So thank you for indulging us.
Good, good, good. Well, I didn't know you were in Chestnut Hill, but that's great. It's great.
Well, yeah. Another time we'll get together for coffee or a walk around the Chestnut Hill Reservoir or something.
Oh, that's a great place. You used to run around there.
In
my younger days. The Brookline Reservoir and the Chestnut Hill was a mile, and the Chestnut Hill Reservoir was 2.2 miles,
right,
or something like that. Yeah.
Well, good.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear a little bit more. Obviously, the main interest for our listeners and readers is really around that connection between exercise and mental acuity. So would love to spend some time there. But I'm curious about your background. And you grew up in a steel town in Western Pennsylvania and avoided the fate of playing football and chose tennis instead.
I played every sport. No, where I came from at that era, you know, for instance, my brother was quarterback on the high school football team.
Wow.
And Joe Namath was down the road, and is in my brother's senior year, he was all county, and Joe Namath was second team all county.
Therefore, it
gives you a little bit of the picture of
great.
And everyone there, my friends, were doing sports to get out of there, to leave, because they didn't want to work in the mill, you know, and that was a guarantee. You know, it was always there for people back way. I mean, the mills were going 24/7, all, you know, 365 days. And many of our parents worked there. And the idea of parents were pushing us to get the hell out of there, to go get educated and have a different life.
Interesting. It was a good living, though, right?
Oh, it was very good living. Union. Yeah. You know, it was very good. It was really middle class.
Yeah.
You know, it was really middle class, what middle class was.
Did you enjoy growing up there?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. No, it was, no, we didn't feel any of that, you know, stuff. You know, the country club set were there, but they were very small group, and everybody was mingled. There wasn't any kind of differentiation. So, and it was all based on what you could do, you know, and what you were doing academically as well as athletically. So I literally played all sports. We didn't have soccer then. Soccer was not part of our deal. But the baseball, football, basketball, and then tennis. And then my doubles partner and I we played all the country club kids in Pittsburgh, but we weren't going to lose. You know, I mean, we were from that era. You know, you don't lose. It's not okay. So we were number one doubles in the East when we were in high school. And I was number six in singles, and my partner was number one, and we traveled across the United States a bit, you know, somewhat to play in Louisville and Kalamazoo and a lot in New York City or New York and Philadelphia. Wow. Yeah, so that was my background, you see.
And how much is that upbringing and that experience as a kid inform your work today?
I would like to say everything, but I didn't know it. Hmm. Okay, it was like, I didn't know that this was really what kept me from being ADHD all the way, you know? I mean, you know, I didn't realize it, how much important it was. I just did it and had fun doing it. But I always did it after that. I played basketball through medical school and, you know, in our choose up teams. And then when I came to Boston and in graduate medical degree, you know, started up basketball teams and played tennis and squash. And then I took up squash and at Harvard and played three times a week until I ruined my shoulder, which is sort of inevitable with a tennis stroke playing squash. And with that, I also had a very athletic family, and my kids and wife, we did a lot of exercise, lots, always.
And that was more due to a passion for sports and an interest in staying active more than thinking of that as a prescription for better mental health, I assume.
Right, right. At first, it was just that. It was just, I just enjoyed it, and the fellowship, the playing, the, you know, getting involved with others. And my writing partner for the Driven to Distraction books, you know, the ADD books, we played two or three times a week squash. He's the one who got me into squash from tennis, because it was a very good game for 45 minutes that, you know, really got your engines going. So,
and good for Cambridge winters.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And so if I had the story right, you self-diagnosed yourself as ADD.
When I discovered it, when I came to realize that adults had it, myself and my partner were definite characters. We were ADHD in almost every way, you know, but contained, you know,
right.
I mean, contained enough. And exercise was a piece of that.
And so
I'll tell you how it really happened.
Yeah, please.
I was beginning to see it in patients in the hospital. This is in 1981, 82, And ADD was not a big deal then. I mean, it's nothing like it was now.
That's right.
And I began to see these people who had been treated as kids with medicine, with Ritalin, and Ritalin mainly,
right,
at that point. And they were taken off of it at 16, 17, because it was supposed to not be effective. It was seen as an addictive substance. So everybody was taken off of it. And so a lot of these people that I would see in the hospital had a history of being on this medicine. So I put them back on Ritalin, and boy, it just was major changes. So I began talking about it, and I talked about it at a cocktail party in Boston. And there was one of the original marathoners there for the BAA, right? Who was also a professor at Harvard and MIT. He was a MacArthur Fellow, which is really amazing, genius grant kind of guy.
Absolutely, right, right.
And he said, can I come see you? Because I was talking a little bit about it. And he said, you know, I've been a marathoner all my life, and I had to stop because I hurt my knee. And since then, I haven't been able to get anything done.
Wow.
I have all the symptoms of ADD as an adult, which was like, and he had been self-medicating all those years.
With exercise.
With exercise. Didn't know it, but this was the story. So medicine helped. Then he began to get rehabbed and much better. Didn't need medicine anymore. I saw him for about 10 years on once a year or so, you know,
right,
just to
right.
check in. And so that really started two careers, ADHD and exercise, in a very big way.
But that was the light bulb moment, your interaction with
right.
him, this marathoner. Right. And did then that caused you to reflect on your own life and say,
Oh, absolutely.
As wonder I where began, I'd be. Yeah. If I had never exercised, I might be a basket case at this point.
So there it goes. So that took off the ADHD, you know, was a big part of my life, you know, as driven to distractions. It's still the Bible for people in ADD land.
So that was 94, driven to distraction, right? The first edition of that. But it seems as if you were thinking about exercise continued to evolve from there.
Right. In all my books, and I've had 12 of them now, exercise is always a key role in terms of treatment. Whether it was, you know, I wrote a book on User's Guide to the Brain. I wrote a book called Shadow Syndromes. I wrote, all the ADD books, we talked about it as being a major contributor to being well. And then what really got me was, so I was always following the literature, right? And there wasn't much. There was not much in the 80s or 90s, but I was always interested, and there was a bunch of stuff going on about depression and exercise. But then in the middle of 90s, there was a big paper that came out in Nature on the effect of exercise on the brain that I see was the turning point, the linchpin for people paying attention to exercise and its effect on the brain. And basically it was by a guy out here at UC Irvine, who was a neuroscientist who was part of a group who studied a big study, international study, looking at what prevented the onset of Alzheimer's disease back in the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s. And three factors: ideal weight, continuous learning, and an exercise, physical exercise. Well, no one had any idea that physical exercise would do that kind of thing, right?
Interesting.
No one.
Yeah.
So he went back and studied it and did this wonderful experiment that I talk about all the time, but on mice, and saw that they got the mice in running wheels. If you did it, they got smarter, their brains grew, they had more of this BDNF stuff. Bingo. That set the world of neuroscience on fire. and this amazing focus on exercise is one way to impact the brain, growth, development, preservation over time. And then it gets into all this stuff in psychiatry that I was interested in that stuff, but in psychiatry into mental health, depression, anxiety, addictions.
Right.
Yeah, all that.
And so was there some resistance to that, the paper you mentioned that was published in Nature? And I'll play some stereotypes here, right? So you have this academic crowd that maybe is not so athletically oriented, stereotypically, right? Broad strokes. And they'd say, huh, wait a minute, you mean the knuckleheads who played football maybe, had it right?
He was ridiculed. Ah. They joked about him, and his mice, his running mice, so yes. And we talk about that in Spark, I think, a little bit, but certainly in our notes, is just like he didn't believe it himself because the results were so profound. The change in 7 to 10 days of the mice running in these running wheels, first of all, they loved it. They were running about 4 kilometers a night, average.
Wow.
Which is a long way for little
mice. That's a lot of strides, yeah.
So they liked it. So what they found was amazing. Their brains really grew. The BDNF, which is brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is miracle growth for the brain, it was increased by 200%. It really turned the world of neuroscience on. And it led, and by the way, it led to a lot of things, there are a lot of discoveries about what actually happened in the brain, because here was something you could change the brain without a drug, without,
right.
You could predict it and see, including seeing that we grew new brain cells every day. That was discovered in 1999. The paper came out in 93, 94. It just like lit the fire.
Right. As a kid growing up in the 70s and 80s, they would sort of teach you that you lose brain cells; they'll never be replaced. You go through this early adolescent growth, and then you never generate another brain cell. But that's not so, right?
It's not true. We all do it every day, and when you exercise your brain, when you challenge your brain, when you stress. See, this is my chapter in Spark on stress. I think I had to cut it by almost a third because it was too big for the book, because I was so fascinated with what, it's a new concept of stress at that time. We thought of all, people think of stress as bad. Well, right, stress is good if it's contained and if you have recovery and repair. That's how we grow. That's how your muscles grow.
Of course.
Yeah, and that's how our brain grows. So it led to all of these incredible findings, including that we make more brain cells and that exercise is the best way to make the most.
And that beats pharmacology or anything else?
Beats everything, And so to unpack that in 2000, from 2000 till now, people are unpacking how this all happens, not just with exercise, but with everything, but exercise is a great promoter of that. So people are all excited, we make more brain cells. Well, that's part of what makes it important for learning and memory. But what is more important, and people get focused on the sexy part. That's really sexy, right?
Growing brain cells from nothing, right?
Yeah. Well, we all do it, but this promotes it incredibly. But what's most important is that exercise changes the whole chemistry of the brain, including the growth promoting environment within the brain. So we get the cell, the 100 billion cells that we have, ready to grow. And that is life sustaining. as opposed to erosion. And that's where the brain is a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger it gets, the better it gets. If you stop, you erode, just like our muscles. Just the same stuff.
And so I think most of our listeners and readers know that they go out for a run, they clear their head, they feel a little better when they get back. Maybe they understand there's some dopamine release and a runner's high, but what's the neurological explanation for why all these benefits accrue?
Well, what happens basically is that you're using more nerve cells, more neurons, nerves in the brain than in any other human activity. And when you use nerve cells, you throw out neurotransmitters. So that the neurotransmitters that people are familiar with are norepinephrine, well, maybe not norepinephrine, but dopamine and serotonin, right?
Right.
And so, but norepinephrine is a partner to dopamine. And those are the major, we call them neurohormones, the major drivers of controlling the brain. And so all of the psychiatric drugs that we have up until now have been focused on those neurotransmitters.
Okay.
Norepinephrine, dopamine, and serotonin. Prozac, Ritalin, Dexedrine.
Mm-hmm.
Antidepressants, you know, those are looking at those neurotransmitters. It's not the real story, but that's what led us. That's what we knew in 1970s, 80s, you know.
Okay. So
what I say you do when they come back from a run, okay, or from working out, or from dance, or from yoga, what they've done is they've used a lot of nerve cells and they've extruded a lot of these neurotransmitters. So it's like taking a little bit of Ritalin and a little bit of Prozac.
It, obviously in an organic way.
Yeah, holistically.
Right.
Plus a myriad of other things. But so that's why people feel relieved, relaxed, better, more motivated. You've changed the chemistry, not just with those, but a lot of other things going on too. You know, you got GABA, you got all kinds of stuff, oxytocin, you feel more connected to other people. Right?
Absolutely.
That's why your running clubs are so successful, because you like to be with other people, especially when you're running and afterwards, because you raise your oxytocin level. Oxytocin is the bonding and love hormone. So we get more of that.
That's our tribal instinct.
Yes. Well, it drives some of our tribal instincts. Yes. So the success of CrossFit is all about that.
And you've tried CrossFit, I understand.
Oh yeah, no, I've ruined, you know, some, I've ruined some joints, and or, you know, had to go to the orthopod a couple of times.
I'm too much of a wimp to do that, but I've done Barry's boot camp, and I never thought in a million years you would get me into a group exercise class. But it's really contagious. It's fun. And it's a little hokey, and you got to give a fist bump. You know, this is pre-COVID, but give a fist bump to the person on the treadmill next to you. And it keeps you coming back for more.
Exactly. And that's a big part of what I recommend, is part of my recommendation, is how to keep at it, is to be in a group, be with another person at least, but a group is, you know, multiplied. Because that keeps you coming back.
For
it
sure.
It has that benefit. And what you did running in Chestnut Hill, you had nature.
Yes.
And nature is another big, huge bonus to this whole thing, to your brain. Now, not to, you know, your body, yeah, but to your brain, you know?
Well, this is part of your work in Go Wild, right?
Yes, exactly.
And so we're huge proponents of trail running. And I think to a lot of people, trail running means a 50 mile ultramarathon or 200 mile ultramarathon. And I think physiologically and mentally, I think it's so much better of a form of exercise, right? And it still kills me back when gyms were open. There'd be a beautiful 60-degree sunny day, absolute perfect day for running outdoors in New England, and you'd see people shoulder to shoulder on treadmills indoors.
Right.
But you've described running or hiking or working out in nature as kind of a force multiplier, right?
Yes, it definitely does. I mean, we know a lot about just nature, what nature does, whether you're, just being outside, being in commune with our biological roots, biophilia. We love being attached to nature, and it does a lot. It increases our endorphins, it increases our dopamine, it increases serotonin, it decreases stress, it all those things that we know makes us feel better, nature does on its own. You add that with another person or a group with exercise, man, you're flying.
Yeah,
your brain is really better.
And what's the evidence or what's the explanation behind engaging with nature and that driving growth of these neurotransmitters versus walking down? You might think I'm walking down a crowded city street. Boy, there's a lot of mental stimulation and visual imagery. Why is nature a better experience for your brain?
Well, first of all, nature allows you not to be so stressed. You walk down the city street and you what's going to happen here? So it's a little bit off-putting, but especially today, but with nature, you still have to be present, even in many ways more so, certainly more so than on a treadmill, because you have to be in the moment. Because of those damn roots, which I tripped over once and stopped my 10K. But anyway, that's another whole story. But, those roots are there, and the grades and up and down and all around, that's one part of it. But also the expanse, the trees, the birds, the changing environment, all that impacts us in a very positive way.
And I imagine you will tell us that running with headphones and listening to music or listening to podcasts probably detracts from the overall experience, whether you're trail running or running on the street.
Right. But it's a matter of getting there. I mean, if this does it for you, if that's right. A way to catch up on the latest music or, the latest horror coming out of Washington, it keeps you going, or can.
But the magic formula, going for a trail run with one or two or three friends, safely, obviously today, that's the real magic formula for
that. That's the secret sauce. Yeah, there you got it. Or going for like my wife and I, we go for a hike just about every other day at least here, because we have a way to go for an hour and a half hike up a mountain, or not a canyon, not a mountain, but
And now for children, to take a half step sideways here, we're lucky. We've got a 800 acre park very close to our house. And really since almost our kids were born, I would force them. It was forcing them to go out and join me to go walk the dog in the woods. And I would say, pretty close to 100% of the time I told the kids we were doing that, they would resist. And about 100% of the time, by the end of the hike and the walk through the woods, they said, wow, that was really fun. We saw some new stuff, but we jumped in a mud bog. I imagine that's really important for the neurological development of children.
Oh yeah. And also their psychological, their memory of that, their self-objects, we call them, the idea that this is someplace that was soothing and wonderful and an experience with dad and the dog, and that's money in the bank for later.
Now, so has resistance receded to these ideas of exercising, growing the brain, engaging in nature, growing the brain? Are there still skeptics?
There are. just as there's skeptics about who won the presidential election, right? I mean, you know, there's skeptics all the time. And, you know, I use a famous quote from Yogi Berra that I wouldn't have seen it if I didn't believe it.
I like that. I've never heard that Yogi Berra-ism.
But, and Emerson had a similar quote. But anyway, but Yogi was it, man. So everybody always asks me when I lecture for, you know, a couple hours here and there, they say, well, why aren't all the schools changing?
Yes.
Why didn't the schools change to incorporate this again or back to the way it used to be? Because they don't believe it. The educators, not the younger ones, you know, who are probably running trail runs or, you know, doing dance or doing yoga, and they get it. But the people in power don't. You know, they did horribly in gym. They hated the athletes, right?
Yeah.
And they're in power. And if not them, then you get our great legislators, you know, and they don't get it. They don't believe it. And, you know, the teachers in power think, oh, gym and PE is only for the athletes. That's what you hear all the time.
Yeah.
And that hopefully will change with COVID, because we're pushing the whole agenda that the way to live with COVID is to be as fit as you can be.
Well, right. It's physical resistance. And then for mental health, I mean, we have three, our kids are teenagers now, and these, you know, these 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. Zoom sessions are absolutely soul sucking. Yes. And they, you know, the schools have all started to send out an email saying maybe they should do 10 jumping jacks in between classes, which is fine. I agree. But yeah, no, that's in the extreme, but parents across the country, I mean, you literally, their faces are ashen by the end of these back-to-back-to-back Zoom classes.
Yeah. It's torture. Yeah. And that's where jump rope comes in. The jump rope is good.
That's a great one. Well, and also you don't want me to get in my soapbox on youth athletics, but my Reader's Digest version is that we spend so much money and so much focus on, let's say, the varsity athletes in a school system. And ironically, the majority of those athletes don't care as much about their school teams anymore, right? It's about their club soccer team or their private tennis club.
I was a soccer dad. My daughter,
so you know,
in Wellesley, you know, three teams a year, you know, every season, three teams, you know.
Yeah. And so, you know, there are literally kids now in soccer and baseball and other sports who will sit out their senior year so they can go to these travel tournaments and showcases. Like, well, I can't play for my high school soccer team because I need to go to these showcases. So, but meanwhile, childhood obesity is at epidemic levels. And so why not redirect some of that money, to my mind, toward programs that will create great lifelong habits and improve mental acuity, you know, in these years? So,
well, maybe with Biden, we have a shot.
Has your phone rung?
No.
No, but really, what have you?
I have lots of hope. I have somebody right there.
You do? Someone who understands that said.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right. Not, you know. Anyway. It's a long story, but anyway, somebody who's in Delaware.
Good. But somebody who has.
Yes.
Hopefully the president's here.
Everything you're talking about, he's 100%.
Great. Yeah. Good. I want to touch, I'm curious what you think of, I will admit, one of my favorite running books of all time, but I enjoyed it, but I was always a little skeptical of Born to Run, Chris McDougall.
Oh, I love Chris. Yeah.
Now, is that, you know, it's not, doesn't, didn't strike me as deep science and peer reviewed and whatnot.
Not at all.
But it, was he on the right track with that?
No, no, it wasn't science at all. The only thing you remember is the gal in it who was a runner. You know, the young lady, I forget her name.
Yeah.
But and I couldn't wait for the movie to see who they were going to get in the various characters.
Right, right.
But no, I don't think he had much in the way of science. He had some, but you know. What was your worry about?
I was curious about, he had this thesis that back in the hunter-gatherer days, we could never out-sprint an antelope, but we could run 6 miles over difficult terrain where the antelope would overheat.
Oh, that's absolutely true.
Oh,
that's absolutely true. That's okay. Absolutely the way it happened. And there is a guy at the University of Utah who showed it. He went and tried to do it here in the United States, but he couldn't. And then he went over to Africa and found out how they did it. Well, they took teams because the animals were really smart, and they would get with a bunch of other animals and you'd lose track of them. But people, they could stay with that animal. They could, you know, continue and tire them out and run them down. No, running with the antelopes, absolutely, absolutely.
And did he tap into any of your research? Did you help him with that book at all?
No. We were together at Harvard. We came to Harvard and we started something with the president of Harvard called Harvard on the Move.
Okay.
Which is now called Harvard Moves. It just continued. With Daniel, oh God. Anyway, the guy who just got us all into the toe shoes.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
The three of us and the president of Harvard, who was a walker.
Okay.
She was a big walker. Started this Harvard on the Move. So we got, all the students were encouraged or set up to do twice a week some activity, and then on weekends longer activities, walking, running, to start with.
But you have written about, I think, something the effect of, we live for 500,000 years as hunter-gatherers, and it's really only the last 5 or 10,000 years that we've lived a quote civilized or developed life. Why is that important for the work you've done, and why is that important for people to understand that in their own brain development, own personal evolution?
I always start off lecturing about that because it's so important. Because in the 3 to 6 million years that we were hunter-gatherers is when our brains grew big. Front part of our brain and the cerebellum, the back part of our brain, grew really big. And it was the same time that what grew big was the area of the brain that helped us move better.
Hmm.
And that became our thinking brain. We used those same new nerve cells that we added on to move better with, to think with, to predict, to plan, to evaluate, to short-term memory, working memory, to switch sets, to switch your strategy. All that was about being the evolutionary victor because we could move better.
Right.
The big thing from hominoids we beat the Cro-Magnon man because they were bigger and smarter and, you know, all that.
Stronger, yeah.
But we could fish. We could catch fish. So we had a steady source of protein. So we won. And they didn't. And, you know, so the Neanderthals, you know, they left. We outdistanced them because, again, we could not only gross motor movements, but really using our hands, and there are people who write about this from the hand perspective, but right. And that's important, but it's really the brain too, about getting the fish and having the steady source of protein.
But is there a connection there between, do we need to tap into those old hunter-gatherer techniques and movements? Is that part of the human fuel? Do we need to do that rather than live a, obviously a sedentary life is not good for anyone, but do we need to, is that part of why being in nature or physicality is important, because we do tap into those old instincts?
Oh, all of that. It's absolutely, absolutely. That's what Go Wild's about. You know, I mean, it's recovering our roots, our caveman roots, but it's with exercise and movement and running and lifting and swimming and climbing and all that is who we were, and that's why it has such a profound effect on our brains as well. To make our brains sing, hum along, promote the learning, you know, because you want to remember where that berry patch is and where the nettles are.
So, right.
You know, so you really want to remember that, and you remember that while you're moving, and you see off in the distance, oh, there's a interesting area. Maybe I ought to go explore there. You know, it's those kinds of things that we want to recapture.
Yeah. And so you mentioned, you know, our more primitive themselves in CrossFit. Have you ever subscribed to the paleo diet?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Is there some merit there?
For a while. I lost about 8 pounds that I didn't need to know, that I didn't know I needed to lose.
Yeah.
You know, probably all the interstitial fat was gone. And I got ketotic. I got there, but it's really unpleasant. Really hard to do, but I have a lot of over the years of a number of patients who it's really changed them
In a good way,
in a very good way.
Yeah.
One guy I never would have thought would do it. It was an addict, heroin addict, you know, and in recovery. But he went on a ketotic diet and it just completely change everything. It's amazing.
And the alternative, I think 80% of the world, or 80% of the calories consumed in the world are some derivative of corn, wheat, and rice, right? And
right.
So carbs, kind of simple carbs, usually. How toxic is that?
Very, very. I mean, we know what it does. We know that high carbohydrate intake is toxic to our cells, including our brain cells. So it brings about quicker aging. It makes our cells, something that I've just learned more about, senescent, meaning they're still there, but they're not effective. And what they do is they dump more cytokines that are not good cytokines into the system, into our world, into our inner world. But they're not quite eroded yet. They're not quite, we haven't gobbled them up, or the janitorial staff hasn't cleared them away.
Right.
They're just there. And that's, you know, a big part of what carbs do, and they feed them, and it makes for premature aging and all of that, and probably depression.
And that can be a factor in dementia too.
Oh no, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Dementia and our fight against COVID as well.
That's good part point.
Of my lecture.
Well, right. And so diabetes is one of the worst pre-existing conditions, right? So
obesity, diabetes, hypertension. Those are the three big precursors to bad outcome with COVID.
So what is, having said all that, a lot of runners, a lot of endurance athletes still consume a significant percentage of their calories in carbohydrates. And I think a lot of them believe hey, if the oven's hot enough, anything will burn in there. But what's your, if you think about an endurance athlete, let's say a moderate athlete who's running 25 or 30 miles per week, it varies by individual, of course, but what, thinking about mental health and physical health, what's your prescribed diet?
Well, I mean, it's hard to get away from carbs. We're so indoctrinated. We're so addicted to carbohydrates, and that makes it really tough. But in my book, in Go Wild, my co-author was really into the paleo.
Okay.
Lived in Montana and ran 100 miles.
Oh, okay.
Mountains, you know, at times, and completely ketotic. So he didn't need to have a candy bar. He didn't need to have, you know, anything. He could depend on his own fuel from his fat cells. And, you know, he was tireless. And so anyway, but that's a, you know, and many people talk about that, but the diet is it's important to know that carbs are your enemy,
mm-hmm.
and that you need to be very careful about carbs. And vegetables is a great way to bring in carbs, but you want to stay away from bread, from pasta, from, you know, that kind of stuff.
Makes sense. And how about thinking mostly about brain health, mental acuity, how do you think about alcohol and caffeine?
Well, I like them both.
a lot of our listeners will be relieved to hear that.
But in moderation, you know, I mean, yeah. Caffeine is a great stimulant. You know, before we had Ritalin, people were using caffeine, coffee or Coke, you know, to treat kids with ADHD. And when I spent a week on the Apache Reservation in San Carlos, Arizona, wonderful week there, and working with the Native Americans, this is a long time ago now. And the teachers were using Coke for their difficult to manage kids. In the morning, they'd bring them in and give them a Coke or then coffee in later grades.
Seems counterintuitive, but okay.
No, but it slowed them down, you know, it made them handleable. But you'll like this story. So I went to this brand new spanking junior high school and you know, they had a lot of money and, you know, somebody was anyway, building a brand new area, a brand new junior high. So I was talking to the teachers there this one day, and I said, and they had really great outdoor facilities, right? It's a desert, they're in the middle of the desert.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And so I said, do you guys really use, the kids really like gym and their recess and all that? And they said, well, we have 4 recesses a day. And when it rains, we send the kids home because they can't control them.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah. The exercise was just like with my index patient there, help control their brains. So when it rained, they couldn't have enough activity. You know, they couldn't get out and play their various ball games and whatever. So they sent him home because it was too
chaotic. Wow, that is fascinating. All right, I have to ask you about one urban myth. My kids are convinced this is true. They are convinced that they've heard 75% of Harvard students are on Adderall or Ritalin during finals week.
Oh, I imagine that's not... I would guess it's, I don't know if it's that high.
All right.
But they're probably pushing the envelope there, you know, as it more mythology, but
is that dangerous if you're
but to be fair,
yeah,
a lot of those students have ADHD as well, and especially at MIT. I mean, my office was between Harvard and MIT. That's all I saw. Professors, students. I mean, a lot of them. I saw all kinds, but sure, a lot of students. And we used to go, when we broke the news in the early 90s about ADD, they brought us over to MIT to lecture for a couple of years, because their psychiatrists didn't know much about it, right? I mean, it was unknown. This is before our book came out. So we would go, I'd go over there and talk to them, and got to very involved with the MIT population. A lot of my patients in some of my books are MIT students and Harvard students. But you know, they're brilliant beyond belief, okay?
Sure.
But they also had ADHD, a lot of them, you know, the sort of, they'd only be able to do what they were interested in doing, you know, but boy, could they do that.
Yeah. And so is there a high correlation then between ADHD students and academic achievement?
It depends. I mean, there's certainly a correlation between low achievement for a lot of, I mean, you know, you're talking about a wide scatter. I mean,
sure,
IQ points are
very
important there, you know, and a hopefully a good enough parenting and a good enough teachers early in their career, whatever. I mean, you hear about it all the time, but our books are full of, the ADD books are full of very high achieving people. Initially, yeah, that's all we saw when we started talking about it. I mean, we saw the CEOs, the entrepreneurs, the creators, the professors who were hidden, you know, they said, oh my God, this is me, you know, and they read our stuff and they came in and, you know, and stories that we later wove into books. I mean, the CEO who could only read on his Stairmaster in the morning, he could only read that. That was it. And another one who had a 3 or 4 mile run in the morning, came in and did all his phone calls in the morning, because by 11 a.m. he couldn't do anything. He was, you know, in ADD land. So
fascinating. And is that, but are there dangers to the, to the pharmacology? Are there dangers to Adderall and...
No, much less danger than Monster Drink, Red Bull. Less danger than those drinks, you know.
All right. I want to ask you about one more correlation. We did a survey among our readers just to get a little handle on who our readers were and what the demographics were and whatnot, and how many times a week you run, and you know, what do you do for a living kind of thing. And I think we got a first batch of responses. It was pretty good. We got 3,000 or 4,000 responses, and more than 50% of our readers have a graduate degree.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, this
surprised me.
Yeah. I was surprised, and I said, well, this can't be right. Well, let's go out to people. Maybe that's just, you know, self-selecting group. The first people to respond went almost to the 51% in the second tranche came back and said, yeah, graduate degree or more. So why is there a correlation between, I mean,
well, think about it.
Yeah.
It doesn't strike me as odd at all. I mean, one, they have the grit to be a runner. Okay. You know, they have the grit there to pursue what it takes to maintain their running. Secondly, the advantage that an exerciser has over a non-exercising student, I think, is fairly demonstrable and pretty important.
Mm.
Everybody says, well, what about the dumb jocks?
Right.
It's usually one of the first questions that the audience asks, you know, and I said, well, think about how dumb they would be if they didn't exercise.
You're not allowed to say that in today's politically correct world.
Exactly. This was back when I started. It wasn't so politically correct. No, but think about our amazing athletes who do 4 hours a day of physical training. Think about them and what happens when they stop. And I always use Michael Phelps as our example for ADD and for addiction.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
When he stops, bingo.
Yeah, that's right. Very good example. All right, I was going to move to a wrap up, but you mentioned one thing I've got to get your opinion on. So seems like I've read more recently that grit is overrated. If you read in a lot of articles and literature 10 years ago, it's, oh, grit is the single greatest determinant of someone's future success. And then the pendulum seems to have swung against that. What's your view?
I don't know that the pendulum swung away. I'm not aware of it swinging away. I teach a course at Pennsylvania with Angela Duckworth, who's Miss Grit.
Oh, amazing woman. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I teach and then she teaches the next afternoon. I teach the morning. And I'm doing it this weekend on, you know, remote, but it's for the positive psychology course there anyway. So, so I think it is a very great concept. And I do think that it's all about resilience, you know, and building that inner ability to be, to overcome obstacles, especially with COVID, especially in our COVID world.
Yeah, great point. Great point.
You know, especially, you know, you have to be able to pick yourself up off the fucking mat, you know. I mean, really.
Yeah. No, you know, that's a great point.
It's incredible. It's going to be, and more so, I don't know, in the past 3 weeks, I've heard of so many people that I know have been touched by COVID.
Yeah.
And the first little while, you know, the first while, not so much, but now it's so pervasive.
I agree. And we're seeing in our schools.
More so.
Yeah. No, we're in for a tough winter.
Yeah.
Well, so I wanted to hit we'll wrap up. I'd love to hit you. We've done this with a few other guests,
sure.
A couple of rapid fire questions. We've really over the last few weeks got some interesting responses. So, favorite movie of all time.
The Treasure of Sierra Madres.
Oh, wow.
It goes way back, I know.
That is a great one. Oh, excellent. No one said that yet. I like it. Favorite book?
Crime and Punishment.
Ah, good. Okay. Russian classic. If you could have dinner with one person, dead or alive, who would it be?
Shakespeare.
Oh, wow. That would be fascinating. Good. This one, I'm hoping you're going to come out my way on this. I don't want to lead the witness. If you ruled the world and you could eliminate smartphones, iPhones, or let them continue, which way would you go?
That's hard because it's such a part of our life right now. It's hard to think of not having them. You know, it's our computer. Right there, you know, and or eyeglasses now, you know, what the hell, you know,
right.
But yeah, no, I wouldn't admit eliminate them. No, I'd keep them.
Yeah. Well, see, I have teenage kids, so I would say,
I
want a 6-year moratorium and then they can go back to them when they turn 21 or something, maybe. So, no, that's a tough one. Best mentor in your life?
Best mentor?
Yes.
Yeah. I've been lucky to have a number of very important people. One of my teachers at Harvard, you know, with Alvin Semrad, this guy's name, you wouldn't know him, but he was the inspiration for a lot of Boston psychiatry in the glory days when we were it. And he was all about getting to know the patient.
That's good. Any of his work accessible to a mere history major like myself?
Teenager, no. It's pretty. It's no.
Thank you.
I mean, there are books about him, but it wouldn't.
But his stuff is pretty esoteric. Got it.
No, it's. Somebody wrote a book about him, The Heart of a Therapist, you know, and it sounds cheesy, but it's really not.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good. So you are such a good sport, Dr. Rady, to put up with us. And I know you've covered these subjects before, but I just think coming at this from a perspective, tuning it to our audience of these endurance athletes is just, it's really important stuff. And I love hearing it. I've got another 40 questions for you, but we'll keep this to a digestible level for our audience and let you get on with your day of enjoying Southern California weather while we enjoy, 4:15 PM sunsets and 38 degrees in rain.
One thing I'll tell you.
Yes, please.
Is out there with the dark, everybody should get a lamp. Everybody should. Amazon has them for $30. A light box. Great. $30 now. It used to be $250. But now for $30, you can put it right beside your computer in the morning. 30 minutes, change your life. It's as good as a run.
Wait, sorry. So this is to kind of recreate more sunlight hours?
Yeah. Well, what it does is it impacts your, you've heard about SAD, seasonal affective disorder. That's the treatment. You all have SAD in a mild way.
Very interesting. All right. We're going to look that up and link to some of those.
No, it's really, really important. I mean, I wrote about it when it first, I'm so old. I go back to the guy who did, wrote about this from NIH. And my patients in particular are vulnerable to this.
I bet. Yeah.
So anyway.
There you go. It's the most interesting part of any meeting is when you're walking to the elevator, right? And it's like the old Columbo. One more question.
Don't forget.
That is great. We will look a couple of those up on Amazon and recommend them. That's excellent.
And it doesn't have to be expensive. It's just $39, whatever.
Love it.
Okay.
Thank you so much. And we hope you're back in town here soon. And it'd be great to get together in person. And buy a cup of coffee and we'll go for a long walk in the woods.
Okay. Sounds great.
Good stuff. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.